again, and that means we're having a show. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation here on the Sam Nation Radio Network. We are very much firmly implanted, deep behind the orange curtain, and in our undisclosed location. And no, we're not, well, not exactly broadcasting, but laying down this track for you to enjoy here within hopefully about an hour's time. So, all right, let me tell you. First of all, I'll tell you what kind of a week this has been. This has been the kind of week where I was debating on whether I was going to share this with you, but I was at In-N-Out yesterday. And my in-laws are in town. And I had to go to the bathroom. And my particular In-N-Out, it's a tiny little bathroom where there's one urinal and one stall. So clearly this is a bathroom that is still intended for biological men, as far as the urinal is concerned. But at any rate, I was in there and I'm walking in with my father-in-law. You know that awkward thing where you're not quite sure who's going to take the urinal and who's going to take the stall. So I did a little dance. I was a gentleman and let him have the urinal, which was a big mistake because I'm not going to give a play by play here, but I managed to somehow drop my whole wallet in the toilet. And and by the way, this is an interesting thing. What's your reflex when that happens? This happens with people's phones all the time. I've never done this before. So I dropped my whole wallet into the toilet, and yes, I will be wallet shopping this weekend. It was a reflex. I just grabbed I pulled my wallet out of the bowl, and then of course washed it off in the sink, and then went home. I pulled out all the credit cards and IDs out of my wallet, and I laid them out on my kitchen, you know, countertop, and just I sprayed them right with glass cleaner that has pneumonia in it. It's like it's a biohazard now. So yeah, I had cash in there, receipts. So I'm going to spend that cash very quickly. I'm going to tell you that right now. So that is the kind of week I have had, and on top of it, it's been kind of an interesting week to track in the news. Because as best as I can tell, I don't know. Where is this race going? We're still talking about an election that is a year and a half away. We've got big news in the, I guess, I suppose, in the fact that Trump yesterday decided, and as promised, to fully release information related to the spying on his campaign in 2016. So that process technically now takes some time for the declassification order to take effect. Expect a lot of information to come out. This clearly is a signal, right, that Trump knows what's in there and knows that it helps him. And he knows that it's critical that he's fighting, and he gets this, right? He understands he's fighting a case. He's fighting for his case in the court of public opinion. This is no longer a legal matter. As much as the Democrats want to make this about their committees and investigating and using the various police powers they think they have to chase after Trump and his associates, we're kind of beyond that. And the admission from a smart media savvy guy like Trump is right now that this is a case that has to be proven directly to the American people. Now, to that end, the charade with Nancy Pelosi at the White House and Trump storming out with his giant note card that was eagle-eyed people and photogs spotted, where he had all of his talking points written out. What do you make of that? Right? Do you think it was all did Trump walk in there already pissed off and then had his whole spiel written out beforehand? Yeah, of course he did. He knew exactly what the Democrats were going to do when they walked into the White House. To that extent, what would have happened if they had played nice? They're not going to. And that's the takeaway here. They're not going to. And the Democrats are that predictable. The story was, right? The story is that Trump threw a fit. The story is that Trump is a child. The story is that Trump's the predictable one. But the playbook here, easily foreseeable, chartable, mappable, predictable playbook here is being acted out on by the Democrats. And they have decided right now that the next 18 months, right, between now and the general election, that these next 18 months, they have to keep this Mueller thing alive. They've got to keep the special investigation into the president's un-American activities, his obstruction of justice, collusion with the Russians and others, his self-dealings, et cetera, et cetera. All of this, they intend to keep it alive. The problem is, right, what's the thing? Well, if you've got a fire burning, even if you want to maintain a slow burn, what do you need for it? You need fuel. And in a political fire, what do you got? You need facts. You need things to come out. You need justification. Because at some point you run out of just put your own political capital to keep whatever it is that you're pushing be taken seriously, even by a fawning and doting media. And so I look at this and I see it's another week of the same thing. It's another week of the Democrats not figuring it out. They're going to continue down this track. And the interesting thing I glean, I promised I ended last show abruptly. We were out of time, up against the clock. But I'd mentioned to you that my wife had been in Washington that week before. And she went to the Congressional Ladies Luncheon, which is it's a little bit of a sexist title because it assumes that it's really a lunch, where they host the First Lady of the United States. And it's meant to bring all the spouses of congressmen together for sort of a feel good event. And so now, of course, as you know, we do have female congresspeople. And so there were a number of men at the event because we have male spouses or partners of those folks. Now, Sherry did end up having a very pleasant conversation with a bearded white dude who turned out to be it was not producer Robbie. It was the boyfriend of AOC or the partner, I think she calls him that. So that was interesting. But this is where I think it's fascinating. There was after this luncheon, they went to a caucus meeting where it was just the Democrats in Congress. So it was the spouses and then the members themselves. And Sherry ended up with the Democrats, right, because of Ben McAdams. And she's there. And in this entire 2.5-hour dinner, speaking to all these congressmen, hearing from Nancy Pelosi, and by the way, Sherry ended up entangled in a conversation with Nancy for a better part of 30 minutes. She was not slurring her speech. The conversation, as it turns out, was not doctored by Rudy Giuliani. But I digress. So in this entire 2.5 hours, there was no talk about Trump the villain. There was no talk about, and Sherry came home and she was so surprised by it. She goes, so this is what I really commend the Democrats because they didn't say anything bad about Trump. Well, one guy did. Our congressman here in Newport, Ruta did. Ruta was trashing Trump, but everybody else wasn't. And I said, Sherry, this is, you know what the takeaway here is? They don't believe it. They don't believe it. The outrage is a play for the cameras. It's Marxist theater. In all the investigations, all the grandstanding, you know, Fat Jerry Nadler, you know, crucifying, you know, people wanting to calling up all these, you know, people of tertiary importance in the Trump administration, calling them up and questioning them and subpoenaing documents. And it's all a show. And the show is primarily, by the way, a function of economics. Right now, every member of Congress, and especially all of these Democratic contenders in the primary, you know, they're building what do they need to advance themselves at this point? Money. They need dollars. If they don't have the dollars, they're out of luck. In fact, there's a number of Democrats that have to show by the end of June that they've raised, I don't know, $1 million, $500,000, big money in some of these smaller districts, in order to prove to their central political committees that their candidacy is viable. And the way that the left right now is fundraising, the people that are giving the money are the people that want Trump, you know, persecuted. Don't forget what the initial call was after Trump was elected. Do you remember this, right? Before we had Trump Russia, before we had collusion, before we had any of this. First, Trump was not a legitimate president because he stole the election, right? And Hillary had a majority of the votes. And Comey, remember, well, Comey used to be a Democratic bad guy, right? He was the guy that screwed Hillary Clinton and cost her the election because he reopened the investigation into her emails when they were, remember, discovered on pervert Anthony Weiner's laptop. So remember, it was the first thing we heard was that Trump didn't legitimately win the presidency because Hillary had the presidency stolen from her. And the second thing that we heard right from the get-go, before there was any talk of Trump obstructing the investigation into his collusion with the Russians, we heard what? That Democrats were calling on one another to resist Trump. The real obstruction here, the real declared intended obstruction of Trump's presidency, started with the Democrats' self-described resistance efforts before Trump even took office. And it was these calls that were so, well, not just blatant, they were specific, and they were taken up. And this is why Trump, through Barr, his attorney general, now declassifying the information that, or the documents and various sources that we have related to what these intelligence agencies were doing when they were spying on his campaign in 2016, will show that the political call to resistance turned into an actual action, right, on the part of law enforcement agencies and intelligence agencies who took it literally. And so this is why the Democrats in private, they don't even want to touch this. They're using it out there. It's a drumbeat in the media. They're calling, you know, they're saying every nasty thing they want about Trump. But I don't think they believe it one bit. And that was, well, that's, and I think that's what, right? I think that is what you see when you get into these events and you get a peek behind the curtain, you get invited into the inner sanctum. You realize they're far more interested, you know, what foods are in the buffet line than they are into whether or not Trump is really the arch villain that Nancy makes him out to be. Now, when we come back, I want to tackle this topic, this hot topic of abortion, because I think I just have been mulling this over in my head and I have some thoughts. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, here on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And Sam Nation is a solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
Five, six, five, six.
Murjovsky, Sam Nation, here on the Sam Nation Radio Network, making radio great again, your voice of reason in an insane time. Now, I'm rolling up my radio sleeves here to wade into what I think is a very, very, very tricky subject that I need to make simple for you. Abortion. My entire personal social media feed for the space of 2 or 3 weeks here, since Alabama passed its draconian new law, essentially eliminating or forbidding all abortions that aren't medically necessary, aren't signed off on by, are either not emergency or not signed off on by two physicians. My whole feed has been, as maybe yours too, inundated by people going absolutely bananas about this. My favorite one on there is that if you don't have a uterus, don't deal with, don't tell my uterus what to do type of stuff. I'm only quoting that very loosely. Now, a big picture here is, first of all, is that the position, it reads well on Instagram. I get it. It's cute, right? Don't let, 20 men can't decide what we women are going to do with our bodies. And it reads well. And a lot of people are forwarding this on. You've probably experienced this. And it's stupid and vacuous, because what if you have a man that stands up for your, if you're pro-abortion, you got a man standing up for your, if he's doing the right thing, how does the fact that he's a man make him, make his pro-abortion opinion somehow less important or less material? The answer obviously is no. And that's points to the absurdity of these pronouncements. Now, the big issue for me, I look at these things through a legal prism. And I look at what casework, what body of law already exists. Because to step away from the political hysterics of this, your first question has to be, is this actually going to change anything? And if it is, how, well, okay, if you think it will, if you think that there's going to actually be change in America and that these laws are going to stick, essentially forbidding all non-essential abortions from taking place, do you think that this is something that the Supreme Court will uphold? And to this point, I have a couple of very important things to tell you. Not a lot of people are talking about this. One, the Supreme Court has decided on this in a very involved decision that's been attacked by a lot of people. But Roe v. Wade is established law and has been established law since 1973. The Supreme Court, no matter what the shifts that occur, I would say, in the balance of justices, right, more conservative, more liberal, the Supreme Court as an institution does not like to overrule itself very often. There is a concept in the law, it's called stare decisis, and it is these are cases that have been decided, right? Then the Supreme Court doesn't like to reopen things unless they feel that they were decided poorly. Now, I remember, as a funny side note, I remember there was a case about class action lawsuits. And when I was in law school, there was one case, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and they decided on this case one way. And I was in the middle of a contracts class, and I was learning the case law, right? I was preparing for my final exams. And in the middle of that class, the Supreme Court overturned itself. It came out with a new ruling, which I thought was terrible, it doesn't matter what it was. It totally changed the case law. And we went to the professor. This is, by the way, funny in law school. So what do you do if you're teaching a class like that? Well, if it were me teaching the class, I would make haste and redo my final exam so that my students are learning the most current law. But my professor was lazy and likely an affirmative action hire, and so he said, no, no, ignore the new law. So for the purposes of that exam, I'd go with the old law. But as a general rule, courts do not like to reverse themselves. When they do, I will explain to you when we come back why they do it. And my answer might surprise you. Now, remember, I'm coming at this from a legal perspective. And I'll share with you too my moral standing on the subject. Let me take this one step at a time. So bear with me. We're going to take a quick break. And when we're back, we'll get to the meat of this matter. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, back right after this.
I was listening the other day to a friend of mine. His name is Sam, Sam Rogowski. You'll find him very interesting. He's very stylish. He's always wearing his suit. And if you want to hear someone's opinion that absolutely is correct, you listen to Sam. Anyone else is a waste of time.
Rogowski, Sam Nation here on the Sam Nation Radio Network. And here we go. So this question of abortion, right? The case in Alabama, new legislation is very prohibitive. I have the text of it. But basically, the essence of it is, and the synopsis of the bill is that the bill provides that a woman who receives an abortion, although she won't be held criminally culpable, the doctor, right, there's felony charges for the doctor, the physician, unless the abortion was necessary to prevent a serious health risk to the child's mother. Now, this bill is now in direct contravention. It's set up, right, for immediate challenge. The bill can't even go in effect, right, because it is in contravention of established law under Roe v. Wade. And Roe v. Wade, I don't know if you know this, maybe a little brief repeat of what Roe v. Wade decided. And I have to generalize here because it's a little hairy on the constitutional front. But basically, in the first trimester of a pregnancy, states cannot infringe on a woman's right to an abortion. In the second trimester, it's kind of a wobbler. You know, they can impose reasonable restrictions. And in the third trimester, you basically need a note from the Pope. Now, and by the way, there's a strict scrutiny standard, which is legalese for it. Like, it's going to be any efforts by any state to tamper with this or tinker with this is going to be held to the highest level of legal scrutiny. Okay? So with that said, Alabama passes a law like this. Missouri, I think, has one coming up or just signed one into law, too. Number of states. What they're doing is they're hoping to set up a legal challenge where the court, where an individual will sue and say it was unconstitutional. And they're hoping that the Supreme Court of the United States, now that they've got all these new justices that Trump put on, are going to say, yes, we want to hear the case. Now, the process by which the Supreme Court takes cases is called certiorari. We call it, or granting cert, C-E-R-T. That's the short for it. And that's basically, it requires 4 out of the 9 justices to say, yeah, we want to hear the case. Most cases, just so you know, most cases do not get granted cert because the Supreme Court can possibly hear every case. And so, and if they feel that the lower courts have made the right decision or that their previous decisions on it are clear, they will remand the case down to the lower court for either the lower court's decision to stand or they'll give some instruction. And that's the end of it. The big gamble here for these people that are pushing this this new legislation, of course, is that this new Supreme Court actually wants to wade into this controversy. And I'm not so sure they will want to. I don't think they will. Again, no crystal ball here, but let me tell you why. And the way I can explain this, you're going to be the smartest person around after I take you through this, because you'll be able to take a very emotionally charged topic and tell people what you think is likely to happen here. And here's what you do. You tell somebody, you ask somebody, you go, hey, is a state banning gay marriage, is that constitutional or unconstitutional? And of course, people will say, well, no, that's wrong. It's unconstitutional. And I go, when did the Supreme Court decide that it was an unconstitutional violation of our civil rights? And the answer is it was in 2015. The Supreme Court case got decided in 2015. So here's my million-dollar question for you, and you can pass this along to your friends when you're talking to them about this here on Memorial Day on Monday, barbecuing. Abortion seems like a great topic, so here you go. You ask them, well, was gay marriage not – before this case was decided, was gay marriage not constitutional in 2014, 2013? 2010? 1900? I'll give you even a better example, because this case is still fairly recent. You want to go, you go back a little ways. Go back to Loving, 1967, I believe. Loving versus Virginia. Overturned state prohibition on interracial marriage. Now, we look at that today and we go, what the? I mean, God, how is interracial marriage wrong? I mean, I don't even get that. Of course, it's unconstitutional to ban interracial marriage. And to that point, the decisions don't come at the point in time, right, that something suddenly becomes wrong. The decision comes when public opinion and public sentiment catch up with our Constitution. It's a very unpopular position, but I'm a realist, folks. I'm coming at this I'm still a pretty young guy, but I've been around the block, and I recognize that for something like interracial marriage, it took our country getting to a point to accept it. And the question here then isn't a bunch of legalese on abortion. The question is, where are we as a country? Where are we on this topic? Where is our consensus, our moral consensus of right and wrong? And there are two extremes. I'll tell you. The governor, you know, the Northam guy, Mr. Blackface, boy, he stepped in it. Remember back in January. He got out there, and I'll read those comments in the next segment, what he said. But, you know, and basically they were pushing a law that allowed abortions all the way to the bitter end. In fact, terminating a child that potentially would be born and would be alive, which certainly is not where we are as a country. That's heinous. On the flip side, I don't think that we as Americans are in a place where we think it's absolutely appropriate for the state to force a woman to bear the child of her rapist. It's just not where we are. It's never going to happen. And if you think, by the way, if you think that just because Justice Kavanaugh is Catholic, and Neil Gorsuch, you know, is morally opposed to abortion, you think that they're going to rule on that more on their own personal moral basis, then you misunderstand that you're buying into all the hysterics that the liberals spread. Because it's the liberals, by the way, that contort the law in order to justify extreme positions. But for the most part, a true conservative justice will take his feelings and his moral judgment out of deciding legal cases. And there are lots of examples in that of that in history. And I, so, you know, so what I think here is that everything you need to know about how this plays out lies in the Roe v. Wade opinion. And the Roe v. Wade opinion is that the first trimester is the first trimester. You know, you it's protected. And I don't, and then there's, then you can have more scrutiny after that. I think that's a reasonable position. I think it's a position that not everyone agrees with, right? But we are not a country that caters to every position. We are a country, we're a democracy. And we are a country that caters to the majority opinion. And that depends, that majority opinion truthfully does impact how the court rules, because the court does take into consideration certainly what changing attitudes are. And I think actually tries to stay ahead of them. So today, you know, we look at interracial marriage. We go, what the hell were we thinking? Of course it's okay. In 1967, it was a controversial topic, but we began to understand that prohibiting interracial marriage was not okay. And so the Supreme Court stepped in. I have more thoughts on this. Let's take a quick break, a quick pause. What does Europe do? That's an interesting question. You probably think that Europe's very progressive, right? Well, not necessarily. I'll explain when we come back. Sam Rachofsky on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
You're looking for a show that doesn't sugarcoat the truth. Sam Nation will accommodate you.
Sam Rachofsky, you know, I was just telling you that Governor Northam in Virginia had said some truly crazy things about abortion back in January. Let me read to you this quote. This is him. This is the governor of Virginia, right? Big time Democrat. Also a guy who may or may not have posed in blackface in his medical school yearbook. Quote, when we talk about third trimester abortions, these are done with the consent of obviously the mother, with the consent of physicians, more than one physician, by the way. And it's done in cases where there may be severe deformities. There may be a fetus that's non-viable. So in this particular example, and listen to this, guys, listen to this. In this particular example, if a mother is in labor, I can tell you exactly what would happen. The infant would be resuscitated if that's what the mother and the family desired. And then a discussion would ensue between the physicians and the mother. What does that sound like to you? Murder? Euthanasia? I mean, it's something straight out of the Third Reich. I mean, I don't want to get dramatic. I know it's the Dems that like to throw out the Nazi label, but eugenics, right? The kid comes out. The baby is breathing, has a deformity, and you talk about it. You go, well, maybe it's better if we don't have a deformed person living in this world, and they kill the baby. Make the baby comfortable. That's a direct quote. That's not where we are as a country. I can tell you that right now. Certainly not where I am. Now, you know, I'll tell you something, too. I alluded to this last few weeks because it's really pissing me off on this topic. You know, it's the Democrats that are always yelling about the environment and about how global warming. I mean, we're just, you know, AOC has given us 12 years. Somebody else gives us 20. I mean, the countdown clock is here. And it's all science, right? It's all science. And they want to convince us of impending natural disaster based on science. And of course, we know the science is heavily politicized and influenced by how the data is read. And so, yes, temperatures may be rising and there's other indicators, but is it all man-made? Who knows? Blah, blah, blah. But science has done something. And this is my asterisk. This is my footnote to what I was saying earlier about changing attitudes. Science has given us a lot of advances since Roe happened, right? Roe was decided in 1973, and since Roe, for example, well, 3D ultrasounds, let's start there, right? We see that there, I know we have three kids. We've had, you know, and we've thankfully, for the most part, had fairly straightforward and easy, uncomplicated pregnancies. But we, you know, but you become emotionally invested in that little peanut that's inside of you. And you can see the peanut and you have these great scans that show great detail. And we now realize, by the way, viability has been moved up too, right? We realize that, you know, kids that where there are complications in pregnancy, children, you know, that are a lot less along. Women that are a lot less long are able to deliver premature infants and have them survive. And, you know, my wife and I have been for years involved with the March of Dimes Foundation. The work that March of Dimes does is incredible. And there are children born every day in the United States that survive, thanks in part to organizations like March of Dimes and tremendous medical care, who can be legally aborted. And it's interesting, I think, as science advances and as we are able to make viable life that before we could not, it may actually lead to a more conservative opinion on abortion than we as a country were willing to embrace in the 70s and 80s. Now, I don't know. This is not, I don't have necessarily a firm opinion on that. I'm throwing it out, though, as something that we need to think about. Because it's two part. One, it's viability. And the second is just the technology that we all now can see and we can be convinced of, I think, that this aborted fetus is a living being with certainly a future ahead of it were it not for the intervention of the mother and the physicians. So this is all a very tough topic. Interesting, I want to talk about Europe. I haven't forgotten about it. So in Europe, we look to Europe a lot of times, especially the political left here. Glorious Europe, the old country. And I want to tell you what they do. Sam Rogowski, back right after this.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, on the show tonight is Sam Rogowski. Now, what Sam is the leading word in correct thinking, as opposed to Ed, which is drunk thinking. And that's usually where the left ends up, on the wrong side of right.
Sam Rogowski, yes, in Europe's 28 member states, I'm talking about the European Union specifically, there are countries that ban abortion outright. With very little exception, Ireland being one of them. I think Ireland and Malta are the two countries that ban it completely. And then Poland's pretty restrictive. Has, you know, Cyprus, Poland are pretty restrictive. And then for the most part, most other countries have a very similar rule to ours where they do it in a matter of weeks. The trimesters, we do it in trimesters. But in other words, I have an observation about this that I think is also an important part of this conversation. And that is that the European Union, you understand, right, these are very different countries with very different cultures and languages, and they've banded together. We understand this, right? We've been in the news. Brexit, you know, is a reflection of people not wanting to co-join themselves with other countries and other cultures and other ideas. But one of the things that the European Union, critical components of the European Union, is standardizing laws, standardizing tax codes, standardizing penalties, standardizing rules so that you basically, whether you're living in Sweden or you're living in France, you kind of are dealing with the same legal structure. And this has been, for the Europhile technocrats in charge of the European community, this has been the thrust of their life work. So isn't it interesting that the European Union hasn't really wanted to touch it? I mean, doesn't want to touch the abortion issue. They see that as a third rail, right? They're not. Yeah. Jean-Claude Juncker, the presidente of the European Union, is not going to tell all the Catholics in Ireland that they should start aborting babies. And the observation I have that we're a big country. You know, we've got 330 million people, and we feel differently about this topic in different places. You know, some rules need to be decided for our entire country and grave matters where civil rights are affected. But also, this may be an instance. I could see one of the outcomes here, not being from the Supreme Court. Like if the Supreme Court were to accept the case, I could see the Supreme Court possibly returning this back to the states, possibly. And Europe is a great example of it in the sense that here you have this autocracy in Brussels that controls these 20 odd European countries. And they're all very different, but they're trying to homogenize everything. They're trying to make everything same, reduce everything to the ultimately the lowest common denominator. And there are a few areas, but one of the few areas where they're unsuccessful has been on this topic. And so maybe the key to us all coexisting is to allow California to do things differently than Alabama, and vice versa. Now that of course also has some implications to it too. It's complicated. This is a very complicated subject. But do not believe for one minute, this is the takeaway, do not believe for one minute that this is a slam dunk thing that the Supreme Court's now going to pick up and run with, and that abortion rights are over with in this country, because I just don't think that this is where we are. I don't. And the Supreme Court absolutely, even conservative justices, okay, they absolutely do look to national mood. And that's what I think. All right. When we come back, yes, I'm at Brexit. This has all reminded me there's big news in Great Britain. I'm going to tell you what that is and why it matters, and some other stuff. Buttigieg, he's surging. I'll tell you about that. Sam Rejofsky, Sam Nation on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
We shall fight on the airwaves. We shall fight on Twitter and Facebook. We shall broadcast our program, whatever the cost may be. And if Sam Nation lasts for 1,000 years, men will say this was their finest hour.
Hi, Sam Rejofsky here on a Friday afternoon, enjoying a... beginnings. I think the beginnings here of a nice weekend. Here where we are in Orange County, deep behind the Orange Curtain, I have been trying to plan my weekend, and I've been trying to plan it around the weather. Now, on my iPhone, I've got that weather app. I'm sure you use something on your phone along similar lines. And every time I open that app, the weather forecast is different. So I'm trying to move around a beach day. I have to do some advanced planning as I've got family in town. I swear to goodness, it was raining on Sunday, then it was raining on Monday, then it was sunny all weekend, then it was partly cloudy one day, but no rain. Then I opened it up again yesterday, and now it was supposed to be sunny on Sunday and rainy on Monday, which is bad. I prefer it to be nice on Memorial Day. So it was bad on, nonetheless, then it got all muddled up again, and now it's Now it's raining on Sunday. And that was all before I started the show. What is it now? What is it now? Yeah, it's still saying rain on Sunday. But sunny. Now full sun on Monday. So keep your thumb in the air and see where the wind is blowing from. When I was a kid in elementary school, I don't know, maybe fourth grade or fifth grade, Bill Keane, do you remember who he was? Bill Keane, he was the weatherman on CBS, and we didn't have a TV growing up. But I was an avid CBS radio listener because they had the KNX Drama Hour here in Los Angeles. And I listened to that every night. So I knew Bill, I was like maybe the only kid, only like nerd in the fourth grade who knew who Bill Keane was. But he came into our school to talk about the weather and being a weatherman. And I guess, I don't know if a kid asked him or if he volunteered it, but his take on being a weatherman was coming to work in the morning, guessing what the weather would be, and then going home to figure out if the guess was true or not. And that was like well, not much has happened since 1988, I'll tell you that. Okay. Before I get into Brexit, before I get into what's happening in Great Britain, let me just talk about my friend Michael Avenatti. Just for a minute, indulge me. If you haven't heard, Avenatti got hit with new charges. This time, the authorities are claiming that he misappropriated a whole bunch of money that was his clients, that belonged to Stormy Daniels. Now, I don't like to get too much into "see, I told you so" moments, but please let me just give you this little clip from this program. This is all the way back on May 11th, 2018. So what is a year ago? Me talking about Michael Avenatti.
Michael Avenatti, the supposed lawyer for Stormy Daniels, everything he's doing is putting her in a really, really bad spot. She's singing like a songbird, violating herself into millions of dollars of penalties. She's already broken one agreement. She's already proven to turn on one man in her life. Avenatti may soon find that another more savvy and enterprising lawyer will come around when all of this just fizzles and Stormy Daniel ends up screwed, and I don't mean in the sense that she's used to. Then some lawyer says to her, hey, you know, you got a really good claim against this Avenatti guy.
And that's exactly what happened here. So Avenatti, right? He gets fired by Stormy Daniels. Stormy Daniels says, enough, I'm moving on. She gets a new attorney. The new attorney does everything right. And you know how I know that? Because we haven't heard boo from him. We don't even know who he is, really. He's just a guy. But he's representing her. And the first thing that he does is he says, all right, I want an accounting of all the money. I want to see all the documentation. I want to see everything that's gone back and forth. And guarantee you, right, Stormy Daniels, you don't just call the FBI and say, oh, I think I got robbed by my lawyer. This is not how it works. Trust me, it's not how it works. The FBI is pretty busy. And this is a politically charged deal, and they don't really want to get involved. What happened is she hired an attorney, and he methodically and carefully went through everything. And the reason that I knew that he was up to no good generally was because the part of his representation that was visible, that was open and obvious, it was so bad and was so unethical that surely, I mean, again, if this is all that he's been charged with, this is the tip of the iceberg. So my prediction is that this will continue to unravel. He is toast. He is toast. Now, where was the fawning media on Michael Avenatti around the same time when I was making this pronouncement about him being shady and that he was eventually going to be hoisted by his own petard? Here is we pared this down as much as we could, but this is a great montage of Avenatti being hailed in the media for the hero that he was to the left.
He's Donald Trump's worst nightmare. Michael Avenatti.
He's out there saving the country.
Don Meacham says he may be the savior of the republic.
You are something of a folk hero now.
I owe Michael Avenatti an apology. I've been saying enough already, Michael. I've seen you everywhere. What do you have left to say? I was wrong, brother. You have a lot to say.
I am just dying to hear what you think.
These people all like you.
I'm the only person right here Donald Trump fears more than Robert Miller.
We think you guys are the tip of the spear that's going to take down Donald Trump.
Michael Avenatti's a beast.
That's true.
And he's
a beast.
He's a beast.
But he has a bigger calling here, that being a lawyer is minimal compared to what he's doing.
No one has talked tougher directly to Donald Trump on TV than Michael Avenatti. And Donald Trump is afraid to mention his name.
Michael Avenatti is laying down the law as guest co-host. And is he really thinking about running for president?
You look at the field of Democrats right now, and Avenatti's the one who stands out.
People would be foolish to underestimate Michael Avenatti.
I am dying. Right. And Joy Behar is the best. I think you recognize her voice. Being a lawyer is minimal. It's minimal compared to this. You know what, Joy? You're right. And guess who else shared the same view? Mr. Avenatti himself, because what this thing was from the get-go was Avenatti being in it for Avenatti. And one of the hardest things as an attorney, trust me, there are lots of cases that aren't even public cases, but you get invested as an attorney representing a client. And I'll tell you, I care so much and I want to win. And then caring for the client and me winning, and I have to check, you have to, I'll speak for myself. I have to check myself because I have to remind myself that the client's best interests are not necessarily best served by my ego being satisfied with the outcome. And this is what lawyers, right? This is where lawyers get a bad rap because naturally, being a lawyer, law school, the legal profession attracts people who are very opposite of Mother Teresa. And are ego-driven, and these are people that, you know, that sometimes get their own priorities tangled, unnecessarily tangled up in their client's case. So this is what happened here. Avenatti used Stormy Daniels like the HOE that she is. Stormy got used and eventually went to a different attorney because it always comes down to money. And at the end of the day, she was doing all these appearances and he was promising her she was going to get rich. And guess what? She probably wasn't getting very much money because she was making appearances at strip clubs where men were shoving singles into her, you know, unmentionables. And she's going, Avenatti, where are the hundreds of thousands of dollars that we're making, that we're raising? Oh, don't worry, baby. I gotcha. You're out of here. So, yeah. And by the way, didn't Avenatti get her into the predicament where she owes Trump a few hundred grand? A couple million now. Oh, boy. You know, I want Jim Comey, before Avenatti gets his license taken away and gets put in jail, I hope Jim Comey hires Avenatti. That's a dream team lineup right there. Okay, we're going to take a quick break and come back and let me catch you up on what's going on in Great Britain. Sam Rejofsky, Sam Nation on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And Sam Nation is the solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
News out of Great Britain today from London, Theresa May, the Prime Minister of the British Empire, just kidding, what's left of it, is stepping down. What happens, by the way, when something like this occurs? Well, she's actually technically stepping down as party leader, right? Her party is the lead party in the coalition, so and it's the Tory party, the Conservative Party. And the Conservative Party then will have to pick a new leader, and that new leader will become the new prime minister. That's how this will work and play out. Of course, Jeremy Corbyn, who is the opposition leader, who is the left-wing communist freak that's in charge of the Labour Party, himself wildly unpopular, he's demanding a snap election. He wants an election today. And the reason for that is he's hoping, when a party doesn't have a good leader, right, the leader's stepping down, that's a good time to have an election. The opposition usually picks up a few votes. They don't have to do that, so they're not going to do that. Now, the man I wish could be prime minister of England, of Great Britain, is, of course, Nigel Farage. Because Nigel Farage is one of the best people in Britain right now, period. And you know him, he was the one who led the campaign for Brexit. He founded the UKIP party, UKIP. And from there, after he got Brexit passed, he retired. And then as Parliament, as all the politicians began to dither and wither on the issue of actually, well, how to, was it Brexit? Is it unconditional? Do we leave with certain terms? Like, how do we do? What do we do? And in behind the scenes, all of the politicians that didn't want it, they did what? They did the same thing that the American left has been doing to Trump. They have resisted it, and they've thrown every possible obstacle in the path of a Brexit. And it really, in my view, and not to digress here too much, but my view that the Brexit deal is really easy. The EU wants England, wants Great Britain to pay for its freedom. And my take on this as a negotiator would be go F yourself. Literally. If you want us to pay you a bunch of money and you're threatening us with tariffs, right? If they leave, what can the EU really do to extract this money from them? They can create a situation where Great Britain has difficulty. British people have difficulty traveling to the EU, living in the EU, working in the EU. The flow of money, the flow of trade, et cetera, et cetera. But and I think the most offensive thing, man, if I were British right now, I would be so offended because the net flow of cash for the entire period that the EU has been in existence has been from Great Britain to Brussels, not the other way around. Now, look at the Czech Republic. That's an example. I'm pretty certain the net flow of euros has been to Prague, not from Prague to Brussels. In other words, if the Czech Republic were to leave the EU, I could see Brussels being kind of pissed. Hey, we subsidized you a-holes for so long. We'll pay up. But the absurdity, the offense of Jean-Claude Juncker, this bureaucrat leech, this disgusting, worthless, subpar human being who is basically a high-functioning alcoholic, shows up to parties staggering, shows up to public functions drunk. And he's the head of the EU, right? The chairman of the EU, whatever his official poobah title, right? And how can they even demand this with a straight face? And the answer is they want it tied up. And Theresa May is out today as prime minister because she was too wimpy and incapable of standing up to this BS. These are people that have to be stared down. I know these European leftists like the back of my hand. I'm a citizen of two European countries on top of being a European, an American. I know Europe. I know it better than most of you. I'll tell you that right now. And all that the next prime minister of England needs to do is reach into his or her pockets, pull out one middle finger, pull out another middle finger, and be like, I don't know, like something. Are you feeling lucky, punk? You know, Clint Eastwood could have done a better job as prime minister, for Pete's sake. And she went into it and, oh, and this and that and maybe what we could do is this and how can we please you? And she went and on an apology tour, I'm so sorry that our people voted this in and I will make this as easy for you as possible. And they knew it, that they had a sucker. They had a mark. They had somebody they could take advantage of. And so Nigel Farage comes out of retirement. He's a wealthy man. I don't know if you know this about him, but he's a self-made multimillionaire who went into politics because he finally had enough of European meddling in his business affairs, right? And he just saw where the country was headed, giving up its sovereignty. The British are proud people, giving up their sovereignty to these, you know, Belgian waffles in the EU. And he said enough is enough, and that's United Kingdom Independence Party. And a core tenet party platform of Nigel Farage's party was separation from the EU. And he was one of the people that really pushed the Brexit referendum. And when the Brexit referendum passed, he retired from politics. Well, lo and behold, we're back at this. We're back in the soup. And you know, I'll tell you, he's back with his Brexit. He started a Brexit party. And he's founded a party whose Nigel Farage has. Yeah, that the only purpose of the party is to push through Brexit. It's like a single purpose party. And they're winning their they've got a bunch of seats now in the European Parliament, and they are doing fantastic because people want it. They want out, and they want enough of this seesaw dithering. Now, May's not a stupid lady, and she knows how. She's very polished. She can say all the right things, but her instinct sucks. And so I want to tell you how that factors into this this political debate that we're having right now about the future of our country. I want to give you some thoughts on that as we look to the Democratic contenders for the presidency leading to 2020. Sam Rzhovsky back right after this.
I was listening the other day to a friend of mine. His name is Sam Majowski. You'll find him very entertaining. He's very stylish. He's always wearing his suit. And if you want to hear someone's opinion that absolutely is correct, you listen to Sam. Anyone else is a waste of time.
Sam Rzhovsky, Sam Nation, rarely wrong, always right, providing analysis steps ahead of the mainstream chatter. And to that extent, let me look at Pete Buttigieg. This, I told you again, this, I feel like this is such a self-aggrandizing show today. But I told you that Pete was the guy to watch. And yes, because now I think he's, first of all, he's taking votes away from Beto O'Rourke. Beto is sinking like the Titanic. Right. If Kerry got swift boated by the Bush people, then I think Beto got U-boated by Buttigieg. And the reason I say this is because aesthetically are the same type of candidate, you know, young and dynamic, fresh faced and everything. The problem is Beto is close somewhere. I don't know where on the scale, but might be brain dead. He live streamed a session at his barbershop where he was getting a haircut. And as part of that session, they started trimming his ear hair, and he got into a discussion about trimming your ear hair. And you guys had to endure the opening segment here. I'm talking about dropping my wallet in the toilet. If you've even gotten this far in the program, you know that there's certain things you don't want to listen to, you don't want to hear, you don't want to. Anyway, so the guy's just dumb. Politically, Beto is dumb. Buttigieg politically is very smart. Now, he had on Sunday got a real softball town hall thing. You know, they're doing these right now on Fox. They are doing these town halls. All it really is kind of like this Q&A, moderated Q&A with a candidate. It's a great opportunity for candidates to get a lot of airtime. And if they're dumb, the Democrats that are refusing to go on Fox are dumb, because Fox is a huge audience and you get a lot of play from it. And free media this early on in a campaign is critical. I cannot overemphasize this. This was Trump's winning strategy in 2016. He got, well, even before 2015, right? He got a lot of free airtime by taking, he would take any media appearance that gave him any opportunity for some airtime. So Buttigieg is doing the right thing. He went on Fox News and of course, Chris Wallace, thank you, did a great job of giving him every softball pitch imaginable. Trump was seething, tweeting out while it was going on, what the hell's going on at Fox News? But I'll tell you, so Buttigieg, where was he? He's holding steady at about 6 to 7%. Surged up from 2.3% back in March. That's when I first began tracking it. And he was nowhere to be found back in January, right before he entered the race. He was not one of the contenders that was being spoken of. Now, I want to tell you why he'd make a terrible president. And he'd make a terrible president because of the instinct that I was speaking of last segment on Theresa May, regarding Theresa May. This week, Buttigieg, he's been blasting Trump. He's accusing Trump of all sorts of things. Dodge being a Dodge drafter. Thank you. Draft Dodger in Vietnam. Man, told you it was a long week. Draft Dodger in Vietnam, faking a disability, right? But he had a big thing this week. He was really pissed off about Iran. And he's coming at it, right? He served in the military. He served in the Middle East. And he said to Trump that it's not a game. It's not a show about Trump's escalation in Iran. And I saw this and I heard him say variations of the same thing over and over again on the news. And I thought this is exactly why he would make a terrible president. Because what's going on in Iran, right? We're already now de-escalating. This was 5 days ago when he said this. We're already de-escalating. But the way that you deal with crazy Iranian tyrants and these ayatollahs is you tell them, you make one move and I will annihilate you. And then you back it up. You send, you know, an aircraft carrier task force out there into their, you know, backyard. You make a threat. You follow it up with real action and you scare them into backing back into their corner. And make no mistake, this is leadership. Theresa May is no longer prime minister, is stepping down in July, I should say, but will be stepping down as prime minister because she could not say no to Jean-Claude Juncker in Brussels. She couldn't just instinctively understand that this was what the British public wanted. They wanted separation. The result of the election was real and not some fluke caused by a momentary blip in the, you know, solar system or something, right? And didn't understand that her entire political, I don't know, a career depended on her delivering on the result that the British people expected. And here, this to me, I see Buttigieg as an equivocator. He's a really smart guy, really polished guy, but a wobbler. And he is the closest thing to Obama. And I don't mean this in a flattering way, but he is the closest thing to Obama running right now on the Democratic side. And it terrifies me because he has all the glibness. He's got all the, he's a silver tongued devil. He has all the right words. He's got all the right responses. He's an attractive candidate to the untrained type. He's going to shine in debates. He's going to cut through a crowded field. Trust me. But he's not the guy that you want leading the country, leading the military, because he is, well, he, you know, he's a consultant. At the end of the day, he worked for a big consulting firm where they decide, how do we optimize, right? How do we maximize, optimize? How do we make more efficient? How do we tweak this and a little bit of that, little less here, little more there, and make everything better? That's not leadership. That's not the guy that builds a business from scratch. That's not the person that's making bold moves and innovating. It's somebody who is a maintainer. And maintaining is what Obama did for 8 years, and it was a freaking foreign policy catastrophe. Because he was very good at traveling around the world and apologizing for us and bowing his head and trying for everybody to like us and like him. But in the end, nobody respected us. And the world around us changed. Between the Crimean Peninsula, the Middle East, and elsewhere, it was all North Korea. The whole world under Obama, if you track it, it all went to crap. A safe America is a strong America. And what Trump's doing right now in the Middle East, those are bold, muscular moves that scare the Ayatollahs back into their corner. And that's what you want. Sam Rojofsky, back right after this.
You're looking for a show that doesn't sugarcoat the truth. Sam Nation will accommodate you.
Sam Rojofsky, Sam Nation. One of the big things that occurred this past week, Justin Amash, who is a congressman, a libertarian congressman, Republican congressman, called for impeachment proceedings to begin against Trump, that it was time for impeachment. And he laid out his reasoning. I, by the way, disagree wholeheartedly with his reasoning. But of course, the fawning media ran with it, because whenever the media has somebody on our side that dares, is bold enough, is brave enough to take a stand against this criminal thug president that we have, and they become a useful hero. Now, I think within 24 hours, 48 hours, 36 hours, it was like within days, we found out that Justin Amash is planning a run against Trump, either in the primary or as a libertarian candidate. So it's a political move, a purely political move, and disappointing, actually, for someone who I always thought was a kind of a principled actor in the political scene. You know it's bad when even Mitt Romney is not quite down with your tactics. Listen to this.
Justin Amash has reached a different conclusion than I have. I respect him. I think it's a courageous statement. But I believe that to make a case for obstruction of justice, you just don't have the elements that are evidenced in this document. And I also believe that an impeachment call is not only something that relates to the law, but also considers practicality and politics. And the American people just aren't there. And I think those that are considering impeachment have to look also at the jury, which would be the Senate. The Senate is certainly not there either.
Bingo. And that's what it is, right? You know, the jury, the people that vote, yay or nay, there's absolutely no way that the Senate will do anything, because, and this is where I disagree with Amash, is that he's got, I've read the Mueller report, and what you have in there are a lot of unpleasantries about Trump. And by the way, it's still on my desk too, and I got these, it's like, what is that, 3 inches, it's like 3 inches of paper on my desk at home. For all you haters of Trump, I killed a tree to print that report. So choke on that. But anyway, I'm reading it. It's not there. It's not there. And it's funny to me how a smart person, like a congressman, I think he's a smart guy. I've always respected him. How he can read it and see in it the elements of a crime. I don't see it. And I'd be perfectly willing, by the way, to admit that the Mueller report, if it were any different, I'd be perfectly willing to admit the Mueller report suggests that there is a crime, and I would certainly tackle the impartiality of the Mueller report, because every person that worked on the report was an anti-Trump stooge. The whole thing was a setup. But to me, when I take the fact that it doesn't have any clear conclusions, coupled, right, with the fact that it's filled with people that despise Trump and want to take Trump down, when you sic that kind of hate at somebody, bias, and still can't come up with any dirt, the worst you got is that he swears in private and it might be a bit too tactical and cunning, right? Or, you know what I mean. There's... You want disgusting. Take a look inside. Look at Bill Clinton. Right. I mean, it's just showing me, and it ought to show you, that the Democrats are grasping at straws. And the tacit acknowledgement here that that's the case is coming from the Democrats themselves. Here's Nancy Pelosi talking about this exact idea at the Center for American Progress Ideas conference on Wednesday.
The press is just totally obsessed with the impeachment part of it, not obsessed enough to write the particulars of what we're doing in our committees and how important that is, but just to say, when are you going to do that? Well, if we do, if the facts take us there, that's where we have to go. It has nothing to do with politics. It's about patriotism, and that the facts will take us where we need to go. To your point, I'm not sure that we get any more information by instituting an impeachment inquiry, but if we thought that we would, that's a judgment we would have to make.
It's a big fat no. It's a big fat we're not going anywhere with it. By the way, I love it. It's nothing to do with politics. It's about patriotism. What kind of load of crap is that? It's not about politics. It's about the law. You're either violating the law or not. Patriotism is all fine and dandy. We can all be patriots. And patriotism can mean different things to different people, but the law is the law. The elements of the crime are, in fact, as Romney put it, the elements of a crime. These people just, I mean, and she doesn't want to do it. The press, I love this too. The Pelosi says the press is totally obsessed with this. Hey, Nancy, why don't you check with Fat Jerry and see what he's at? You want totally obsessed? That's the guy that's totally obsessed. All right, don't go anywhere. Almost done here. Almost done here, but still a couple things. Sam Rojofsky, Sam Nation on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, on the show tonight is Sam Rojofsky. Now, what Sam is the leading word in correct thinking, as opposed to Ed, which is drunk thinking. And that's usually where the left ends up, on the wrong side of right.
Sam Rojofsky, Sam Nation. It is graduation time for many parents out there. They are quite relieved that the hemorrhaging is over. I think this is why parents love graduation so much, college graduation. It's like, wait, did we send the last check? Like, is it over? For other families, it's a bittersweet time. You know, they paid a lot of money to get their kids in, and now they're charged with felonies, and their kids have been booted from school. So that's, you know, that's kind of It's a sad time of year for those people. I went to the Chapman Baccalaureate last – when was that? Well, it would have been at the end of last week, right? Because Chapman graduation was on over the weekend. And as you know, I'm on the Chapman Board of Governors, love Chapman University, and my wife and I are very involved with the school. But at any rate, I bring this up because this is the time of year where you hear truly insane things being uttered by putative functioning human beings, right? These are people who supposedly are entering the real world, I don't know, empowered, educated in a way that make them viable, right, and helpful to society. And you realize that higher education has done the exact opposite. Here is Stephen William Thrasher, class representative for the NYU doctoral convocation. He's going to be a journalism professor, by the way, at Northwestern University.
I am so proud of NYU's chapters of Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voices for Peace, and of GSOC and of the NYU student government, and of my colleagues in the Department of Social and Cultural Analysis for supporting the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against the apartheid state government in Israel. Because this is what we are called to do. This is our NYU legacy.
Oh, my God. I don't even know where to begin with this idiot. He probably doesn't realize that, you know, that Israel's the only country in the Middle East where you don't have to be a practicing member of the dominant religion in order to have rights in the country. I wonder what he says about Saudi Arabia. I wonder what he says about Iran. These people are so deluded and sick. And this is a guy, you're going to send your kid to Northwestern. You think that's a good school? I mean, you know, it's the reason we're in this country. My mom taught there briefly. And so this is insane. Northwestern, this guy's going to teach journalism at Northwestern University to your kid. And you're going to be spending what you're going to be spending. What's that going to cost, parents? $40,000 a year now? Undergrad? Big school like that? $40,000 a year you're going to spend on that education to have your child taught by this douchebag. The apartheid state of Israel. Oh, my God. This, and by the way, the Democratic Party has become the party of anti-Semitism. And I'm going to continue talking about this because it is disgusting. It is wrong. It's sickening. But the Democrats own it. They are, with Ilhan Omar and AOC and all these people, they are, Rashida, with all these people, I'm telling you, they are becoming the anti-Semitic party. And if I were a reasonable middle-of-the-road Democrat, like I know many of you are, I'd be sick of this. I'd be disgusted by it. And I would be doing everything I can to bring my party back to normal. All right. We are totally out of time. It's been a wonderful show. Have a great evening tonight into your three-day weekend. Hopefully you all have wonderful Memorial Days. Do not forget what Memorial Day is all about. Thank the troops that have come before us, that have made this country free and have done so many great things in the world, in Europe, as we commemorate Normandy invasion and think about the past. All right. Very emotional. Sam Rogowski, great to be here. Love you all.